Austrian grandparents escaped the horrors of the Nazis. My Iraqi grandparents endured British brutality, and my Iraqi cousins still suffer the impact of the Americans. No matter where the military comes from, occupation equals inhumanity. Since 1948, the Israeli oppressors of Palestine have committed atrocities against the indigenous people. We can remain silent while genocide continues, or we can raise our voices. For the victims who have been silenced, and for those struggling to survive, that voice, that choice, is ours.
Mama Gaza's getting bombed, but nobody's saying it. I'm kinda getting scared now, but nobody's getting it. Today I saw my own cousin's brains getting split. See, they terrorize my days, but say that I'm the terrorist. How can I be the terrorist? Do you know a terrorist? Cause all my life I've been terrorized, so I can't be the terrorist. Trapped behind barriers, life is getting scarier. These settlers celebrate every bomb setting that buries us. Used to death, worried I'm infatuated with bodies of bleak and distorted. Sometimes I wish I was aborted, ripped out of my mother's wounds. I know I'm sick in the morbid, but they cannibals, they animals, they grilling our organs. Auschwitz reincarnated, brought back to life by the victims that were burned by the Nazi lights. The flame ignites again. Gaza children getting white with terrorists come in all ages, even ones flying kites.
فإن لم تحررنا العروبة صنعنا من دمامنا السيوف.
When I was young I used to hear the sound of rockets and hide. My mommy would tell me there were celebrations all the time, so I started celebrating every time we heard that sound. Till that rocket hit the ground, exploded around. Mommy, I'm burning, take me out of the house. But mommy's busy choking on guts coming out of her mouth. أمي حبيبتي أرجوكي أنقذيني من الموت. لكن الأمة تمتلي من الأحشاء والخوف. His precious mother passed away, but son made it alive. His body's scars remind him of the love in his mother's eyes. Still the world blame his soul for holding stones in pride. He lost his mother, lost it all. There's nothing more to lose. Inside a revolution, he has cries from heaven. They're yelling, you got to bring your people together. Fight the oppression, you got to lead now. Your people are in need. Fight and never bow until the last mother effing breath you breathe. Reject the siege, inhale the smell of debris. Protect olive trees as blood cells will leak. But don't fear, we connect through blood, sweat and tears. Love kept me here through all these messed up years.
غزة ولدت الشماخة ترعرع بها أقوى الخلافة. فإن لم تحررنا العروبة صنعنا من دمامنا السيوف. في غزة ولدت الشماخة ترعرع بها أقوى الخلافة. فإن لم تحررنا العروبة صنعنا من دمامنا السيوف.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to The End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Basevich. You can listen to this at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can tune into AxisSacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So the answer to the question of the hour, what should the United States do about Afghanistan, comes down to this. A sense of realism and a sense of proportion should oblige us to take a minimalist approach. As with Uruguay or Fiji or Estonia or other countries where U.S. interests are limited, the United States should undertake to secure those interests at the lowest possible cost. What does this mean in practice? General David Petraeus, the commander of the United States Central Command, recently commented that, quote, the mission is to ensure that Afghanistan does not again become a sanctuary for Al-Qaeda and other transnational extremists. And he went on to expand on that a bit by saying that the mission was, quote, to deny them safe havens in which they can plan and train for such attacks. This mission statement is a sound one. The current approach to accomplishing the mission is not sound, and indeed qualifies as counterproductive. Denying Al-Qaeda safe havens has not required the United States to occupy the frontier regions of Pakistan, and it should not require the United States and its allies to occupy the entirety of Afghanistan. The reality is that as long as we maintain adequate defenses, Al-Qaeda poses no more than a modest threat to U.S. national security. Yes, a threat, but a modest threat. As for the Taliban, unless and until they manage to establish enclaves in places like New Jersey or Miami, the threat posed by the Taliban to the United States will fall several notches below the threat posed by Cuba, which is no threat at all. As for the putatively global threat posed by this thing called violent Islamic radicalism, well, that project will almost certainly prove to be a self-defeating one. Think about it. What the Islamists have on offer, which comes down to a rejection of modernity, it doesn't sell, as recent events in Iran, I would say, have vividly demonstrated. Like it or not, the ethos of consumption and individual autonomy will conquer the Muslim world as surely as it conquered what was once known as Christendom. It's the wreckage that the collapse of Christendom has left in its wake that demands our attention. If the United States today has a saving mission, it is to save itself. Speaking in the midst of another unnecessary war back in 1967, Martin Luther King got it exactly right when he said, "Come home, America." The prophet of that era, who urged his countrymen to take on what he called the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism, he remains the prophet today that we ignore at our peril. That Barack Obama should fail to realize this qualifies as not only ironic, but also inexplicable. So with that, I'll stop. And I look forward to any questions and comments that you may have. Thank you. And my watch says we got about 35 minutes for questions, so that's good. In the center, in the red dress, yes, ma'am. We're making it difficult because you sat in the middle, and it's hard to get you the microphone. So
I agree that we should never have been there. Assuming that the President and Congress agreed with you and said, we're getting out of there, what advice would you give them as to the removal and transport home of the troops and all of the paraphernalia that the Americans have brought with them so that it can be done in a strategic, peaceful, and smart way?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be glib about it, but I don't think that's the hard part. I mean, I would call General McChrystal on the phone. I'd say, General McChrystal, this is the boss speaking. Your mission has changed. Get back to me in the next couple of weeks and tell me how you are going to draw down the U.S. military presence, how long it's going to take, and tell me how you're going to give us some reasonable assurance that we're not going to be abandoning large quantities of very expensive equipment. Just give me your plan, General. And I would say I have a high level of confidence that General McChrystal could put together that plan. Now, I wouldn't tell McChrystal and have the last guy out of the theater in the next 45 minutes or the next 45 days. It would have to be done over a period of time, and frankly, I would want to defer to my commander to tell me what the reasonable amount of time was, as long as I was sure he wasn't playing with me in some way. I think the more difficult question is, were you to draw down the U.S. presence, then what approach would you take to ensure, to accomplish that mission of ensuring that Afghanistan doesn't become a safe haven for Al-Qaeda cells planning terrorist attacks? And there, my answer, the thing I would at least want to explore, would be the following course of action. It's a course of action that assumes, I think this assumption is correct, we'd want to test it, that assumes that the political tradition of Afghanistan is one that is not based on the idea of central governance with effective political authority being exercised from Kabul that reaches to the far perimeter of the entire country. Rather, that the political tradition of Afghanistan is a decentralized one in which effective authority is exercised by people who we can, if we're being kind about it, call tribal leaders or tribal chieftains. If we're not being kind about it, we say they're warlords. But they're the people who are in charge. What we would want to do is to try to provide incentives to those people to govern their little patch of ground in ways consistent with our interests. In other words, pay them to keep Al-Qaeda out. Now, I would not work on the assumption that the people I was paying were trustworthy. I would work on the assumption that the people I was paying were untrustworthy, and therefore I would want to maintain a very intensive, I think, surveillance of Afghanistan, and I would reserve the prerogative of punishing those who violated that agreement. I mean, if Warlord X is indeed allowing the Taliban to take up residence in his area, then X gets punished, and then Al-Qaeda gets punished. That's the approach I would at least take. Could I guarantee absolutely, positively, for sure that would work? No. I have a high level of confidence, though, it would work reasonably well and would cost us far, far, far less than the current approaches is costing us.
Barack, what are you doing in my organic garden on Halloween night?
Well, Michelle, I am waiting here for the single-payer insurance option to rise from the pumpkin patch.
What?
Every year, the single-payer option rises from the pumpkin patch and, supported by a broad, bipartisan coalition, flies through the airwaves and delivers quality, government-run health care at an affordable price for all the good little boys and girls.
Oh, Barack, not again. When will you stop believing in the single-payer option?
When you stop believing in that fat guy with the beard who keeps talking about the North Pole.
Honey, that's just Al Gore. He's harmless.
No, I mean Santa. Well, let's face it, Santa and single payer, both implausible. Santa just has better publicity.
Well, do you really think it will come?
I know it will come, because I have the most sincere single payer option pumpkin patch in the whole world.
Well, 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 what do we have here?
House Minority Leader John Boehner.
Look at you sitting there waiting for single payer option. What a great way to spend political capital. Here, this might help.
Ooh, did he give you some support? Did he deliver a block of votes?
I got a rock.
Oh, just wait. Single payer will be here.
It's just that I think everyone would love single payer if they just knew about it. How do I reach middle America? How do I get the public to pay attention?
Hey, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Yep, sex tape.
No. Would you like to hide in a runaway balloon?
We'd get press worldwide if we fool the news buffoons.
We'll appear on TV screens together, you and I.
And we can fly.
It's worth a try.
Up, up and away, this plan cannot lose. We'll make the news by noon.
The names our daughters will use will change someday. Sasha and Falcon, that's more cinematic.
And if by chance they show us on live TV, it will be so dramatic when I'm found in the attic.
We'll be everywhere in our runaway balloon.
I'll shout single payer and everyone will swoon.
It's a clever plan to finally reach the middle class.
And then at last, healthcare will pass.
And now, back to the end of American exceptionalism with Andrew Bacevit.
Yes, sir. On the aisle, about five rows back.
Six.
My question is comparison with the Johnson administration. People are already talking about how, like Johnson, Obama has gotten, shall we say, overwhelmed by his lack of military experience and political experience, and is very much the captive, shall we say, of a way of thinking that maybe you alluded to in your talk. But how deep does this go in terms of your knowledge of Washington?
How valid is that comparison? Well, my sense would be that President Obama, I can say anything I want, I've never met the man, right? My sense is that President Obama, like President Johnson, views his purpose primarily in the context of domestic reform. And my sense would be that his definition of his purpose is not simply to get us out of this economic crisis, but really to make some pretty fundamental structural changes in the way our domestic political economy works so that he'll not only, if he succeeds, restore prosperity, but make prosperity sustainable. And that's how he will be famous. Johnson thought the way he would be famous was by completing the New Deal with his Great Society plan. And, of course, Vietnam War hijacked the Johnson presidency, destroyed the Johnson presidency, put an end to his domestic reform program. Is this going to happen again with President Obama? I have to say, because I think President Obama is head and shoulders the smartest politician we've seen in the last, I don't know, 30, 50 years. And not only smart, but he really seems to be a incredibly shrewd person. And I am perplexed by his willingness to sort of take up the banner of Afghanistan. I don't understand why he would not be sensitive to the risks of having that war hijack his presidency and therefore torpedo his domestic reform agenda. I simply don't understand that. My speculation would be the following. This is speculation based on no empirical evidence, right? That he says to himself, for me to get done everything I want to get done, I need to be a two-term president. For me to be a two-term president, in other words, to be elected, reelected in whatever it is, 2012, I need to fix I need to restore prosperity. If I don't restore prosperity, I'm not going to get reelected. Therefore, I need to give myself some space to focus on domestic affairs. And the way to do that, in a sense, is in the near term, go along with the conventions of U.S. foreign policy or of U.S. national security policy. Or to put it another way, to avoid giving my political opponents ammunition to attack me as a national security wimp. And in order to do that, given that I ran as the anti-Iraq war president, in order to not be seen as a national security wimp, I'll make Afghanistan Obama's war, hoping that it won't unravel. And then after I'm reelected in 2012, most of my domestic reform agenda is done. At that point, I then focus on reshaping U.S. national security policy. Now, I find that plausible, but again, it's just sort of me making it up. Yes, ma'am, right here in the third row, two off the aisle.
Well, don't we really have a much more complicated history in Afghanistan after the amount of money and effort that Charlie Wilson put into Afghanistan, and the money and the equipment all went to the Mujahideen, if I'm saying it correctly?
Mujahideen, yes.
Would you say how that complicates our efforts to do anything?
Well, I mean, what you're referring to, of course, is that in the aftermath of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, right? So much time has gone. 79. First Jimmy Carter on a relatively small scale, then Ronald Reagan on a much, much larger scale, helped by people like the King of Saudi Arabia and Margaret Thatcher, funded a very aggressive program of support for indigenous Afghan resistance fighters to try to defeat the Soviet occupation. And after a 10-year effort, it succeeded. And this was perceived, as still is perceived by many people, as one of the great victories of, one of the great successes of U.S. national security policy, because by golly, we defeated the Soviets. But I think what you're alluding to is there's no question that the effect here went well beyond simply defeating Soviets. It destabilized Afghanistan, and it helped to persuade a generation of Islamist resistance fighters that they had the capacity to bring down a superpower. They did it once, and they figured they could do it again. So, yes, to some degree, the problem is one to which we ourselves contributed. Now, my sort of beat is relatively recent U.S. foreign policy. So my sort of focus on post-World War II for the most part. And I have to say, the more I think about it, read about it, the more I'm able to distance myself from some mythic notions of U.S. foreign policy to which I adhered as a young man, the more I'm impressed by the way that everything kind of fits together. I mean, let's take as another example, Iran, you know, perceived by many in the United States, particularly many in Washington, as this as part of the axis of evil. You know, this regime, this sort of irrational regime that has this grudge against the United States. What the hell is their problem? And we are oblivious as a people to the larger context and the fabric of U.S.-Iranian relations over the past half century. I mean, I dare say that if we just sort of walk down the streets of Philadelphia and ask the average Philadelphian if they could tell us anything about U.S.-Iranian relations, let's just pick some arbitrary year, 1953. Anything happened in 1953 in U.S.? People, what are you talking about? I dare say if you walk down the streets of Tehran and asked 100 people about that, they'd say, every one of them would say, well, that is the year that the CIA collaborated with MI6 to overthrow a democratically elected government and reinstall the Shah. Well, there are dots that go from 1973 to 1979 and the hostage crisis, through the 1980s when we supported Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, down to the present moment when, yes, I imagine the Iranians are trying to develop a nuclear weapon. I mean, cripes, if you were the national security advisor to President Ahmadinejad, who is a nut, if you were the national security advisor, would you favor developing an Iranian nuclear weapon? You're darn tootin' you would, because you'd perceive, and understandably perceive, the United States of America as posing a serious threat. And you would also cast your eyes over to the Korean Peninsula, and you would take a look at what happens when a dictatorial regime gets a nuclear weapon. And what happens, and suddenly you have deference and respect, which is much of what the North Koreans have managed to carve out in their own weird way. So yeah, it's a bigger story, and unfortunately we Americans tend not to have a lot of interest in that context that you referred to. Yes, sir, in a blue shirt, about seven rows back.
I took a glance at your book before the talk began. You seem to have ambitions, and you addressed it at the end of your talk.
Ambitions?
About understanding the deeper roots of American policy and American exceptionalism. That's what the book seems to be partly about.
Right.
So, and you ended your talk by saying what we're going to do at home. So
what, ought to do.
What we ought to do at home, in your view. So why don't you spell that out for us a little? Where do we go domestically?
Because then you won't buy the book.
No. Oh, no, no, no. I've already bought it, so you've gotten at least one customer already. I'm taking a chance because I've already read one of your other books. If it's supposed to be a tease, then I'll ask it in a different way. What's the use of American power in the world constructively? We appear, and you're telling and looking at the book, we appear to be the threat to other people rather than on a receiving end. So do we have to learn our own history better so we remember what we did to other people that they haven't forgot that we did to them and they still hold the grudge some years later? And is there a constructive use for our policy, say in the Middle East with Israel and the Palestinians, in the way that we could influence the outcome of Israel's policy by the money we lend them, by the cover we give for what they do, by the pressure we could put on them and the Palestinians? Would we have constructive use for our power that didn't require the expenditure of a lot of money?
I think the answer is no, and yes. But let me expand a little bit, because you asked about five questions. I'm trying to figure out how to approach, and I don't want to dodge you at all. I've come to believe, and this is a belief that I think many people would not particularly agree with, and it reflects the fact that I am a conservative, right? And I mean a George Bush, Dick Cheney conservative, I mean a real conservative. That there is a fundamental cultural crisis that has enveloped the country over roughly the last 50 years. And the cultural crisis is not something that necessarily has adversely affected every individual in this auditorium, but I do believe it has adversely affected the great majority of our fellow citizens, and the adverse effect is that we have come to embrace a distorted and unsustainable notion of what it means to be free. The freedom for too many Americans has come to mean basically conspicuous consumption and radical individual autonomy. That freedom is not in particular tethered to some sort of individual understanding of what is true and lasting and permanent. And this is a big problem.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name. Transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name. We invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our name will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow or countries to be deemed evil, not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance, we pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. Real.
in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. Real, real, real.
Now for something completely different.